Hey guys, I don't know if you're like me, but I love Count the Dings and everything it has to offer. I just can't find everything I need. You know, I know about Cinephobe, and I know about the mailbag, and I know about Bomb, but that's all we do, right, Amin?
No, we do so much more.
What?
Yeah, absolutely. If you sign up, patreon.com/countthedings, you'll find a plethora of other content, fresh content, extended content, the OG pod overflow, the Cinephobe cold opens that we've taken and made their own thing to live only there, the Rewatchingtons, Bomb in its full and unadulterated cut, early drops of Cinephobe episodes, and so much more.
Said the OG pod. Now, is it new or is it old?
Mace, I'm glad you asked that. It is a new incarnation of the old OG pod.
Oh.
So it's me, Zach, Trey, Waz, Tom.
I love those guys.
Just like we always were, going back to the True Hoop days, we're recreating that magic, recapturing and putting it back out. We're talking hoops, we're talking pop culture, and most importantly, we're talking for 40 minutes for free, but then another specific Patreon exclusive segment for every one of those episodes.
Funny enough about that OG pod, you're getting Tom and Trey on Mondays, you're getting me and Waz, aka Zosny, on Wednesdays. Amin's floating in between.
I'm a floater.
You never know when you're going to get Amin in those, so you got to listen to them all.
And what if I'm not sure what Maze looks like, because I've always thought he's a fat man with a fedora, he's got a weird voice. How can I see for myself what this Maze character actually looks like?
It's crazy you don't know the answer to this because it's the Cinephobe Pod YouTube page.
What?
The CT5s on the Cinephobe Pod YouTube page. You can look at all of us.
You can get all the OG pods on YouTube too, at Count the Dings 1 on YouTube, at Cinephobe Pod on YouTube. Patreon.com/countthedings gets you everything all in one feed. You can link it to your Spotify. And now enjoy the show.
Tom, are you ready to get artsy-fartsy in the kitchen?
Oh yeah, please pass the Jew.
This is Pack Your Knives. I'm Kevin Arnovitz.
And I'm Tom Haberstroh.
Tom, a night at the museum for the Top Chef contestants.
I guess maybe I was coming down from the high of last week. Wasn't the strongest episode of the season, but there's some gamesmanship here that I can't wait to talk about.
Yeah, I kind of felt the same way. It was all right. It was a 3.5 or 4 stars out of 5.
Yep. It was a middle, not quite in the bottom three, but it was a middle episode.
One new thing. Immunity is introduced for the first time, brings a little more intrigue to the top half of the show. And it's a funny challenge. It is do fried rice, but you have to use some crazy shit.
Yeah, we had two guests come on for this episode, and it was one of those things where I felt really bad because I didn't know who they were. Like, I know who they are, but I've never watched any of their works. So I it's not that I wasn't excited, but I was just like, oh, they're really sweet. And Ali Wong and Randall Park, are you familiar with their work, Kevin?
I was familiar with Randall Park because he played Jimmy Chung on the early seasons of Veep, and frankly, should have played them for the later seasons of Veep. That was a character I liked a lot.
Well, good, because I felt like I was like, oh, everyone's going to kill me because I don't know them very well, and they seem like I should. But yeah, they come on, and we do the fried rice, which, exciting. It brought me back to fifth grade out on Ship's Corner, downtown Westport. All the kids would hang out after school, and we would all get the pork fried rice. It's super oily, greasy fried rice out of the carton. It was awesome. And so immediately when I got this quick fire challenge, I just got nostalgic.
Fried rice is one of the great comfort foods, not something we think about as comfort food, at least in like kind of Anglo-America, but it is truly one of the great readily available comfort foods in the world. But the challenge, of course, is they have to take one thing off of this buffet of madness. Like red like red hot candies. And I mean, what was some of the other crap on there?
Jelly beans, cheese puffs.
Peanut butter.
Yeah, peanut butter. And
watermelon.
It was frog legs, watermelon. I mean, it was all over the place. You know what fried rice is for me? It's a great hangover food. It is like when I wake up in the morning, I want like a bacon, egg, and cheese sandwich, or just go and get some fried rice. This episode was very much stoner college. This quick fire was very much in that vein.
Yeah, and I mean, the one thing that was also nice to see is I feel like fried rice has come a long way. When I was growing up, it was just like – it was, you know, essentially – stock-based rice, and they throw in those frozen peas and carrots, and you knew that's exactly what they were doing. Or those little, like, 70s frozen food section vegetables that were just repulsive. But, you know, they get subsumed in this sort of gravy-ish rice and you know, cooked down, but that was it. But, yeah, it was sort of interesting. To your point, Kevin Gillespie, fresh off a win in last week's elimination challenge, kind of goes with the best version of stoner fried rice. I mean, he calls it bachelor fried rice, which is really just a euphemism. And he does it with a wiener, hot dogs, essentially, Cheetos, and bourbon, which we never heard much about the bourbon. I don't know if that was sort of it was a finishing touch, but it was extremely popular.
And here comes Kevin waltzing in off the win of the elimination challenge and saying, was he the one who said, I didn't really know how to make fried rice?
Yeah, Asian food is not part of my repertoire, yeah. Whatever he said. Yeah.
What a flex. What a flex by Kevin Gillespie. Just waltzing in here. Ah, I don't really know how to do this very technically. Like, I don't know. I don't know what I'm doing. Never done this before. And then goes in and just smashes the most delicious of all the poor fried rice or the fried rice.
And obviously, I mean, the one we've talked about this many times in the past, that for all of the genius of Top Chef, the only thing that's sort of lacking fundamentally in the show and the critiques I've heard from people who aren't into it is that at the end of the day, you can't taste the food, right? You're at home, and when you watch Project Runway, you can see the dress. And as much as we might like the idea of these foods, you can't ever taste it. For my money, my favorite one, she was recognized as being among the top three in the quickfire, was Karen's Nasi Goreng, which is essentially an Indonesian or Malaysian fried rice, but it's done with a sweet soy sauce, so it gets that caramelization on the rice, and then just a fried egg on top. And I am of the Anthony Bourdain school, which is a fried egg on anything makes it better.
Kevin, I was going to ask you, what is your fried rice special? Like, what kind of ingredients or toppings or mixins are you getting in there?
You know, it's funny. I've never made fried rice at the house. And I don't know if I just have one of those gay carbophobe houses. So neither of us eat a ton of rice. We do a farro salad that I like stole from Alimento here in Los Angeles, which is, you know, I do some hot, like a little bit of hot chili because I have to be careful, of course. Cucumber, radish, some green onion, and then some mint, and then top it with like feta. And that is the closest thing to fried rice in my house, but it's not really. It's a farro salad. Who am I kidding? And this has actually kind of inspired me. I've got a wok. I've not used it since I moved to this house. And I've got some oil, and I got some rice. And I got some eggs. So maybe it is time for me to – you know what? I'm going to have some leftover salmon, grilled salmon tonight. Maybe tomorrow for lunch.
Crisp it up a little bit. Yeah.
Maybe it is salmon fried rice with some green onion. And I don't know what, maybe some dill. Is that going to work? No, I don't know.
I thought you're right. The Nasi Goreng was great. It looked like she nailed it. Padma was a big fan of it. Surprised she didn't win with that dish. And yeah, foreshadowing a little bit is like Karen nailed this dish as much as she didn't nail the next dish that she did in this episode. But I thought Leanne had a curried anchovy and beef fried rice that I actually was like really into that one too.
Yeah.
Like,
you know why? Because it had that crispiness too. You know, you get that, you know, that thing that we all get now at the Japanese, nouveau Japanese restaurant, you get like the fried rice cake and they put the tuna tartare on it.
Yes.
It's that texture of fried rice that I think she achieved. And it looked like Karen achieved too, because you get that nice caramelization with the sweet soy sauce. But I'm with you, man. And Leanne also got out of the trap, which is there was too much crazy shit going on that table. If you got sucked into the vortex of shit, you ended up like Nini, who's just been cooking wonderfully, Tom, but tried to put watermelon, which is best served cold and is watery by definition, by name, into a fried rice dish. But I'm with you, man. The Leanne, you know who else had a top three? Was your guy, Eric. Our guy, Eric, but your guy.
Yeah. Team Tom, Eric. Peanut butter and jelly fried rice with the fried egg. I mean, come on, that is delicious. I didn't think it was going to be great, but he came out with a big W on that one.
Yeah, I'm kind of trying to figure out like how the peanut butter worked. I mean, I guess it's no different than if you put, I mean, and you've seen this in rice dishes before, like peanuts, if you did. But he did some ponzu. I'm trying to imagine it, but they loved it. And that was great.
Yeah.
Nini got dinged. Jamie, in what might have been a foreshadowing, got dinged because his spam chunks were too big. And, you know, one of the hallmarks of fried rice is you do that sausage, but it's kind of really, really diced up so that it's like you don't want any ingredient that's much larger. It's much larger than a couple of grains of rice.
You know, I think spam actually works as a fried rice component. I think like if I wanted to build a fried rice dish for myself, you need to get the salty. So you get the pork belly like cubes. And I'm thinking in my head, I'm like, ooh, the spam sounds good in theory, but the chunks were just too big. Much like Nini's, the watermelon, I don't know how you're going to able to pull that off with such big watermelon chunks in there. And I know she was trying to go for like that, like tuna playoff, but it didn't work there. And Jamie with the spam, the shallots, the Fresno chilies, and what whiskey barreled fish sauce, barrel aged fish sauce. Wow. I was surprised by that. That was a really cool dish.
Can we find some of that? I'm actually, hold on, barrel aged fish sauce. Can I buy this shit on?
Yeah. Wow.
Barrel aged fish sauce. I've got something for you. Bliss's Barrel Aged Fish Sauce is a collaboration between Bliss and Red Boat, the finest fish sauce in the industry. Made with Red B-Boat 40N, this premium fish sauce has enhanced its natural flavors through the proprietary aging process for 7 months. Available on Amazon. I'm trying to get there for $27, 200 milliliters. That is some serious business. I might have to, because I use fish sauce a lot now, because it's key in my Vietnamese fish sauce and palm sugar kind of my caramel sauce base that I stole from the Slanted Door cookbook. So I might have to spring on this. I mean, hell, I'm not spending money on anything else.
It says finest in the industry, Kevin. How many are in this industry?
I think fish sauce is a pretty big industry.
Well, the barrel aged fish sauce is what I'm saying. Probably not that many, but hey, I'm a fan. And Jamie, I think, would have won this if he didn't have such big chunks of spam.
Yeah. The other thing, the interesting thing was, is when they all finished in the middle, because when I was watching, I was like, you know, the frog legs are a smart way to go because you satisfy the weird shit requirement. But at the same time, I mean, what a frog leg tastes like chicken, right? That's frog. So, you know, I like Malarkey's tempura frog legs with a fig pomegranate rice. I like Greg went with a frog leg with salt cod fried rice with scrambled egg, which I was certain was going to win. And then Stephanie got good marks for her. She did the Nashville fried frog legs. So she ends up using the Red Hot candy, which I thought was completely unusable, makes it as the coat to her Nashville fried chicken or frog legs. None of those people got in the top and none of those people got in the bottom. So it turned out that frog legs were sort of Your easy
the most
way to
mid, yeah, yes. The most mid component, yeah.
You are a median chef. So Kevin wins. Karen and Eric get kudos. Nini and Jamie get dinged. And most important though, for Kevin, he gets immunity, which looks like it might have come in handy.
Yes, and this is what I was excited about: is Kevin Arnovitz, you win immunity for this episode. You're assessing the teams, and here comes the game theory, right? You're looking at which team can I knock down a strong competitor and therefore have an easier road to the final, because you are knocking down – I would look at the list and see, are there two really strong candidates? Are there two juggernauts on any of these teams? And it looks like Kevin, when he picked his team, I think he was kind of thinking strategy on this.
Well, I mean, here's the thing though. If I'm looking at it from his standpoint, I think, frankly, that, I mean, to me, Rococo with Valtaggio, Jamie, and Lisa, potential there, because I think, you know, Jamie's been middling, Lisa's been middling, Valtaggio is a beast. But I would say, like, don't you want to go with Nini, Malarkey, and Leanne? Leanne's been struggling. Malarkey really hasn't, prior to this week, done anything except annoy the judges. And Nini's solid, obviously. But you really want to go with Eric, who's a juggernaut. Karen's been cooking very well. And Jen Carroll's done nothing but, I mean, she's done nothing below average. So to me, it was very interesting he chose neoclassical in that group.
What's your strategy here? Because if you go to a weak team, you're not really raising the chance that a juggernaut gets in the bottom.
Oh, I see what you're saying. So
you go to a really good you go to a stacked team, you're increasing the chances that someone gets into the bottom.
Yeah. So let me throw a counter argument to you.
Yep.
The counter argument is you can't lose. You can only win if you're Kevin. So don't you want to go to a team you perceive as weak? Because at this point, losing doesn't come with any cost. Yeah, I hear you. You can technically punch everybody down a peg. But don't forget, they're not working on the point system like you're working on the point system and like I'm working on the point system. Kevin doesn't work on a point system. He basically has a free chance to win without any downside to lose. I want to go to the weakest team if I'm him.
That's an interesting theory, and maybe I'm playing Monday morning quarterback here because it doesn't seem like that was his strategy. Because he went with a really strong team. He went with a strong team and mailed it in. So it seems like to me that he was very much, I'm going to just pop in here on this team and knock someone down. And I didn't even think about him going for a win here. I just thought, who is going to have the – and I think Karen was really worried about it. It was like, man, he joined our group and now – I feel like I've got Eric and Kevin and Jen to deal with. So I think the strategy from Kevin's side was he looked at the teams and said, who has the strongest team? Neoclassicism. I just pulled a Jen there. But I think the strongest team, maybe in retrospect, is I think it was Rococo. It's Gregory, Melissa, and Stephanie. Rococo right. is Steph, Gregory, Melissa. And I think that might be the strongest team there.
Yeah, I agree. Let's run through the teams in chronological order. Renaissance, obviously, 15th century. It's emotional. Renaissance art is all those things that make human beings, right? So we're coming out of the Dark Ages where humanity is just at its nadir of existence, and then comes the Renaissance, which is we are humans. We have great capacity for love, for art, for emotion. For wedding reason and tradition and all those things. So that's the challenge. We got Nini, who kind of brilliantly interprets and most simply interprets the challenge, right? She's on the Renaissance team. What does Renaissance mean? It means rebirth. I'm from New Orleans. Now I get to cook my home food and call it Renaissance.
She didn't even need to go to the museum. She knew what she was going to do. She figured out, all right, I'm going to do a play on words on Renaissance and just kind of build into that theme there. And I think it really, really works. And I think that's the strategy you got to go with. The idea, Stephanie went with the other one, which is I'm going to go pick out something I see from the paintings and have that inspire my dish. And I thought she nailed it conceptually. And you saw Nina go in the opposite direction, which is I don't even need to see any of this shit. I know what I'm going to do, and I'm going to nail that dish.
Yeah, and by all accounts, she did pretty well, Nini. It was good on story, clearly well executed, just short on plating. I mean, at the end of the day, they did invest a little bit in plating and in presentation. It was a fundamentally presentation-ish challenge. Speaking of which, Malarkey, Halo of Halibut, really smart. It was a gorgeous plate. Didn't chintz it up with a lot. Just had a nice farro. But highlighted the main ingredient and, you know, cooked his fish. And kind of also mastered the challenge in the sense that I'm going to pick one detail. I'm not going to try to get into the guts of all the characteristics of Renaissance art. I'm just going to say, hey, you know what?
There is a lot of halos.
Right. Like all of these sort of, celestial characters are imbued with this kind of gold dome around them. Hell, I'll do that to Halibut, call it a day. And he did. And he worked, and he got on top from that group. Meanwhile, Tom, Leanne wins the Kutsuji Award for Culinary Chaos.
What the hell was that?
What was going on? I mean, what do you think was going on there?
I don't know. Maybe she just looked at all the different ingredients at Whole Foods and just said, yeah, I'm going to do that paste. I'm going to do that puree. I'm going to do that puree and that puree. And maybe she just... it's almost like she didn't know what to say. And so she just kept blabbering in her head on a dish where it was like, I don't really love this. So I'm going to keep adding ingredients until I get somewhere. And she never really got anywhere.
Right. Let's take inventory here. So the very base of the dish was duck three ways, right? Like duck breast, duck confit, and then a duck egg, whatever that's worth. And
that's
I love duck
a strong
egg.
Start. Right. I like that.
Then we're going to give you a ton of different root purees. a beet puree, a celery root puree. I think there was some bread in there in one of those purees. And
if black garlic puree too.
Oh, yeah, that's right. The black. I'm not even remembering the black garlic puree. And then if that's not enough, Tom. If that's not enough, I've got some poached apples for you. How do you like them apples?
What was that? Like it didn't make any sense. And when she delivered, I think she knew. She knew.
To her credit, she knew.
She knew. And that's always a good sign, is when they're self-aware about their dish. And it was a mess. You said it a couple weeks ago, maybe it was last week, that Leanne is not very long for this competition. And this episode, I thought she had a good start at the Quickfire Challenge. Yeah. Didn't get immunity, but man, she was walking on a tightrope.
So then you got Baroque, you know, lovely period. A little bit ornate. I'm thinking like Bernini's, St. Peter's Square. You got all that good stuff. I mean, that's more architecture. They were doing more painting. But here we go. We got Lisa, who, by the way, we will get to later. She is a free agent. We will cease to be a free agent after this week. Once again, Tom, I got nothing to complain about. You got anything to complain about with the Mexican Chipotle brisket?
No, that sounds delicious. And I thought it was a really strong team. Voltaggio, we're doing Voltaggio yet?
Yeah, we can get to Voltaggio. Yeah. I'm just talking to Lisa.
Lisa and Voltaggio. Look, when you look at a brisket, I'm all in. Anything you do with a brisket, anything you do with short rib, any sort of that meaty, just kind of fatty, meaty dish, I'm all in. And I like the fact that Lisa, kind of inspired by her own roots, the Jewish Mexican brisket, where she was like, yeah, my last name is Portuguese, but I'm a white Jewish Canadian. I very much identify with that, as someone with a last name of Haberstroh, and people think I'm German, but I am not. I'm very much Greek. So my last name should be Kalakos, but it's Haberstroh.
This is my favorite thing. One of my favorite things about you, among many favorite things. I love that you're kind of Tom Kalakos.
I'm Tom Kalakis, and
you sound like you should be on season 2 of The Wire.
Yes, with the Sabatkas.
They're Polish. I'm talking about like the Greek and that whole
game. Oh, yeah. Was it Jimmy the Greek was his name?
I think that was the racist handicapper for CBS. That was somebody else. He was just the Greek.
Yes, the Greek. Yeah, I was very much on board with Lisa on that one. So that dish, Brian with the red snapper, smoked sweet potato, love that one. These were some strong dishes, but I got to say, Kevin, I didn't take art history in college. Not big into art history. So I needed like some cliff notes here when they were describing their dishes, what the periods were representing, because I was lost. There's too much for me to keep track of. And I thought that was one of the drawbacks of this episode, is I felt like I think it was you, Kevin, who taught me when you were my editor at Heat Index way back when. I think you were editing one of my pieces and you said something like, if you don't enjoy writing the piece, they're not going to enjoy reading it.
Yeah, that's actually been one of my mantras whenever I'm slogging through a piece and realize I haven't been enjoying it for the last 45 minutes. I need to erase what I've written, because if I ain't enjoying reading it, you ain't going to enjoy it. If I am not enjoying writing it, you ain't going to enjoy reading it. That's always been my rule.
Exactly. And I felt like that was what was happening in this episode, which was the majority of the chefs here were really struggling with the challenge, and it felt like they didn't really believe in their concept very well. And I kind of felt that a lot, not with this particular team, but just in general with this episode. It felt like there were a lot of stretches here. It was hard for a lot of them to nail the period and what they were representing. And so I kind of felt for them a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, the Baroque, I think, is the hardest one to kind of grasp, because it sort of sits between – it's not so much of a reaction against Renaissance. It's a little bit of, hey, let's take what we go. And whereas Rococo is very easy to understand, right? Like, it's just crazy. Everything goes. It's like the 70s glam of kind of the early, not even like pre-Enlightenment or early Enlightenment, right? And then neoclassical is this reaction against Rococo, right? So it's just like, okay, as Eric said, it's very focused. It's orderly, like a return to kind of clean cleanliness. And he perfectly captured it on his plate. But let's talk about Jamie for a second to close out. Baroque has an idea for a seared chicken breast. He's going to sous vide that bitch. He's going to get this lovely jus that he seems to be into, a charred citrus gremolata, which I think sounds fantastic. And apparently I think was well-liked by some of the judges. But he doesn't get the jus on the plate.
Oof.
Jus did not eat.
Man, you do
nobody
it for
ate the jus.
Nobody ate the jus. It was for guest judge Ludo Lefebvre. How do you pronounce his last name?
Lefebvre. There was a Jim Lefebvre, I think, was a baseball player and then manager at some point. Ludo, have you ever gone to Tuamek together?
No.
Oh, we need to do that. We need to do that.
And we need to go to Wolf's Mouth.
Yeah. Oh, we'll talk about Craig Thornton in a few minutes, but when we get to kind of the table. But Jamie's, you kind of saw it coming too.
Kevin, help me out here. Isn't the whole point of sous-viding something that you're not going to overcook it?
Yeah, I would say that's exactly. It just gives an evenness to the cooking. You know who's a master of the sous vide?
Isn't Ethan Sherwood Strauss?
Ethan Strauss is a master of the sous vide. He can sous vide. He can sous vide a leather shoe and make it taste good. He is a master. Now I have this steam oven that I was encouraged to get, which kind of gives me a little of that sous vide quality. But I've never actually used a sous vide. That is the point, right? You get this evenness. It's supposed to prevent dryness. I do not know a hell of a lot about it, though.
Yeah, I feel like it's kind of a cheat code for doneness, right? I feel like if I'm going to pull out the sous vide for a dish, I'm not going to have to worry about whether it's overcooked or undercooked because it's very precise, right? And I feel like that was bonkers to me, was that when he presented the dish, it wasn't about the jus so much. Like that was a big problem. But the fact that they thought it was dry and overcooked, I just scratched my head. And you know what? We learned a lot, and we'll get to it in the Last Chance Kitchen. He kind of had a rationale for why it might be overcooked or seem like it was overcooked. But this was, I mean, a deal breaker for the fact that you don't put a jus. A, you go with a chicken dish, and B, you don't provide a jus for a French super chef. That was right. You're done.
If ever there was a judge you need to give the jus to, it's Mr. Ooh, and I like the velouté. You know, Brian Vitaccio. like this is a guy who is the master of the five French sauces, right? And I don't think jus is one of them. But if ever there was a challenge where you can't get away with not saucing your chicken, it is the Ludo challenge. And so it was just the worst timing. I do want to talk about his theory when we get to LCK. But that was the Baroque. Group three was Rococo. We had Gregory. We had Melissa. We had Stephanie.
Strong group, and holy crap, did they cook the heck out of this.
Gregory, who, you know what, Tom? Am I correct that Gregory had the second best dish of the night?
Very possible. We had one of these weird, quirky team efforts that kind of jumbled things a little bit because Gregory had an amazing dish and the miso short ribs and the – I mean, you're coming behind Melissa on this one, but man, that would have won in a couple other groups.
Yeah, I think it might have been the second best. You know what it reminded me of is the National League West, 1993. Atlanta Braves.
Yeah, of course.
Right, because this is before the wild card. 104 wins for the Atlanta Braves, and then a San Francisco Giants team that won 103 games. Tom, can you even conceive, because you were very young at that time, can you conceive a Major League Baseball team winning 103 games and not even qualifying for the postseason today, now that everyone gets a participation trophy? This was a team, Tom. Billy Swift and John Burkett each won 20 games. I think well more than 20 games. Rod Beck just was a boss out of the bullpen. You had Barry Bonds. You had Matt Williams. You had Will Clark. You had Robbie Thompson, who had a great year at second base. And yet, so Gregory is the San Francisco Giants of 1993 of Top Chef episode 3. He had
the
second best.
Is this kind of like the Spurs that won the 67 games in the regular season in 2016 and just went right up against the Warriors and couldn't make it out?
Yeah, exactly. So Gregory probably has the second best dish of the night. But second, unfortunately, to Melissa, who her lobster wonton soup, essentially, with a seafood consomme, charred allium oil, which I learned. Tom, do you know what allium is? I don't know what allium was. It's garlic. It's just a fancy name for garlic. I mean, I suspect there's an herbiculturalist and probably chefs who can tell me the difference between allium and garlic. But whatever it was gorgeous. And she has these beautiful peas. It was a stunning dish to look at. And man, just beautiful and delicate. You know, it had the indulgence, as you said, lobster was sort of – it's one of those dishes that actually could have gone either neoclassical, Rococo, Baroque, maybe not Renaissance. But I really – it was just really versatile, and they just absolutely loved it.
Oh, man. I just want to just look at that dish for hours. It was a beautiful dish. I don't know if she had it in a restaurant before, but, man, Ludo was like, I want this at my Michelin star restaurant.
Oh, he said it was a Michelin star dish.
Yeah. Yeah. And you could tell that one, as soon as she started conceptualizing it, I was like, yep, that's going to win. I just had a feeling that Melissa was going to nail this. And it helped, I guess, that she worked at the Getty Museum when she was like 17 years old. That was like one of the first kitchens she was working in. So that must have felt really nice for her.
That's a hometown win. And then we had Stephanie with a mortadella tortelloni poached in an umami nage, which Gail loved, by the way. Some grapes, unfortunately, suffered from just a lack of execution because the pasta was undercooked. Had it not been undercooked, I think maybe she gets dinged a little for the wafy grapes, as Gail Simmons said. But everything else kind of on the plate did well. And so I think of the last placer, she, I think, had probably, you know, someone who might not have finished last in three other groups.
Yeah, but I kind of loved her inspiration for this dish. The idea of like, yeah, there are a lot of curves in this, and I just thought of tortellini. I love that. I thought like the closest of something on a painting in food form, that was it. And then I'm wondering, do you think that Wafy Grapes is a better restaurant name, or is it Umami Nage?
Oh, Umami
Nage. Wafy Grapes, Umami Nage. Umami Nage is a beautiful phrase.
Wafy Grapes, because I guess the theory is if you're going to do grapes, you need to go more substantially, like halved, but you could, really half of a grape is as far down as you can go while still maintaining its fundamental grapiness, I guess.
Hello, listener. I'm sure you don't need me to tell you that we at Cinephobe love our pets. Zach and Boogie are inseparable. I've got two cats and a dog, and Amin is giving his best ass-on performance to convince dog owners that he loves their pet.
Hey, little, hey, boy, how you doing? And Noodle's just like, yeah, whatever.
Which is why today's episode is sponsored by the ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program. For many pet parents, summer is all about making travel plans like adventuring through the national parks, visiting pet-friendly beaches, or road tripping across the country. Wherever your journeys take you and your furry friend, you can help protect them along the way with a plan from ASPCA Pet Health Insurance. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure that your pet's plan is as unique as they are, because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim, and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/dings, D-I-N-G-S. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/dings. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/dings. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance. Hello, listener. Guess who's back? It's me, Anthony Mays, your favorite butcher-turned-podcast producer, and I'm here to talk to you about ButcherBox. ButcherBox is the most convenient way to get high-quality meat and seafood that you can trust delivered straight to your doorstep. Free shipping, vacuum sealed packaging. It's ready to go right then. It's ready to pop in the freezer. You get exclusive member deals and a variety of high quality cuts at an amazing value. Going to the grocery store can be a huge pain. You're usually in a rush at an inconvenient time. You're waiting in line at the meat counter. You're taking a number. Maybe this place doesn't have a number. You're jostling with fellow customers. You're trying to get that ribeye that you want or that nice piece of salmon. Maybe the butcher that you're dealing with has a bad attitude or something. I don't know. That was never me, I promise. But maybe it happens. ButcherBox takes all of that out of the picture. You are always prepared with meat and seafood in the freezer, and you're not going to find quality for this price anywhere else other than ButcherBox. So sign up at butcherbox.com/dings, D-I-N-G-S, and get our special deal. ButcherBox is offering our listeners a free for a year offer plus an additional $20 off. You can choose salmon, chicken breasts, or steak tips free in every order for a year. Sign up today at butcherbox.com/dings and use code DINGS, D-I-N-G-S, to choose your free for a year offer plus get $20 off your first order.
Yes. And look, I think Stephanie, it wasn't a bad dish, but she had to be in the bottom because she was going up against Melissa and Gregory, who two chefs that could win this whole damn thing.
So speaking of the judges, Craig Thornton from Wolf's Mouth was featured. And talk about a guy whose plates are just beautiful art. More Jackson Pollock probably than Baroque or neoclassical. But Craig's brilliant because Wolf's Mouth, and there's a great, if anybody wants to read it, there's a great feature story in The New Yorker by Dana Goodyear several years ago about Wolf's Mouth. And essentially, he was very early in this, hey, let's have not exactly a pop-up dinner, but regular seatings where you're going to apply, you will get accepted. And if you're accepted, essentially it's a dinner for 16 or 20. It used to be held in a downtown loft in Los Angeles. And then Craig did something amazing, which was he either bought or got a bungalow in Hollywood right off of Fountain and blew it out to the point where when you walk in, it is a chef's kitchen. It's like a restaurant kitchen. On to the right and to the left is a table that seats about 20.
This is the place that, Kevin, every time I come to L.A., you try to get a seating there or something. I haven't been there yet. And you're like, this is number one on the list for L.A.
Yeah, absolutely. And when you have enough notice, you should definitely give me a night. It's usually held on Fridays, Saturdays, sometimes Thursdays. But then you go in and you sit down with strangers. And he just proceeds to give you an absolutely gorgeous 7 or 8 course meal. He has a spinoff of Wolf's Mouth, which is really in the same place, same staff, same everything, which is called Shark's Tooth, which is more seafood focused. And I mean, talk about a guy who there's a lot going on the plate, but everything makes sense. I mean, it's a classic, like if Gail Simmons were judging Craig Thornton, you know, there's so much going on here, but yet everything has a purpose. Everything has a meaning and everything speaks to everything else on the plate. Thornton's a great chef. It's also just a great production. The whole gang there, Caleb is wonderful. I see Caleb Chen at the Hollywood Farmers Market, so you know they're getting the good shit. And I'm just such a fan of Wolf's Mouth and was so heartened to see Craig Thornton there as a judge because he's as much a part of the soul of Los Angeles cooking right now than anybody.
Whose dish do you think he loved the most? Like, which one of these dishes do you feel like would have been a Wolf's Mouth dish?
The most Wolf's Mouthy dish might have been Eric, though I would also say that Brian's
Eric felt like
dish,
Brian's too.
Dish,
Brian
and another Halo. Yeah, I mean, just because he would fit in. I mean, Craig Thornton wouldn't fit into any of these four class. I mean, he would be expressionism. He would be, you know, modern. He would be. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's just so much. It is his style again. I mean, I was like, it's more Jackson Pollock than Rubin or anything like that. So yeah, he's. I'm trying to think what else would have been. Now I think those two probably would have had it. Would have been sort of the most Wolf's Mouthy-ish dishes. But
it was good to see him because I knew as soon as I saw him on the screen, I was like, oh, that Kevin's going to love that.
Yeah, this was great. So the final group was neoclassical. And again, you know, kind of Eric defined it very well. It's a very orderly movement, much more focus. Karen comes in with something that could not have been. I'm big on Karen. I drafted her high. I love her, the cooking she's done. But this was kind of the classic misinterpretation. So it's not unfair to say that neoclassical is the simplest of the four movements. That's an easy call. But I think it's this weird extrapolation from, oh, neoclassical is simple. I'll make something simple. And then what she made was rustic. I mean, it could not have been less neoclassical, and only insofar as it was simple. No, it was actually kind of boring. She does a braised chicken with chicories, a brown butter, and like she did rustic food for a neoclassical challenge, which was just an error. And then, you know, apparently didn't execute it all that well, though she's been kind of brilliant all season. Then we got your guy, Eric.
It's a beautiful dish, the halibut, very tweezery dish, very aesthetically pleasing, stands out aesthetically, they said. Man, it looked delicious. It wasn't the most indulgent of dishes, but Eric just nailed that one too.
Yeah, green peppercorn broth just looked great. I have a little hack for you, and Eric knows it clearly. My everyday plates at the house are those nice, almost concrete gray plates, because everything looks more sophisticated on that plate.
Ooh. Like, I noticed that. It was a black background there. Yeah.
So it's a kind of a grayish. I got these plates for my house, and whenever. So all of a sudden, everything looks a little bit more restaurant-y. Everything looks more tweezery. Everything, like every schmear, it's just more. It's a really good hack for making your cooking look more sophisticated and intentional than it actually is. And so that's what I use on my everyday plates. Jen Carroll is an interesting chef right now because, Tom, I feel like she has not gotten a lot of attention. She has not been low. She has not been all that high. I thought the Ludo's characterization was interesting. So she does this seared red snapper, no surprise, right? This is the seafood queen, as Malarkey called her. An apple radish fennel relish looked lovely. Looked like a dish I would thoroughly enjoy as a fish guy. He dismissed it as it's fish and sauce, and I thought it was a telling critique. Is Jen too safe to really sort of get to the finals of a Top Chef?
It's an interesting question, Kevin, because when you look at where you want to be for the first few rounds, maybe it's okay to be high floor. In the beginning, in the first few rounds of Top Chef, at this stage in the game, it might be best served for you to just be a high floor and not get eliminated. Later on, you got to get more bold, more risky, more outside the box. And I don't know if she has it in her. In past seasons, of course, she has done well on this show. So I think that's what you worry about, is that she's going to get too comfortable bringing in and bunting, right, to get on base. You need to swing for the fences. And so far, it seems like Jen hasn't taken those big Barry Bonds swings yet.
Yeah, but cooking well by everyone. Her chickpea stew last week, well-received. I'm always interested. One of the things that happens on this show, just from a production standpoint, is when you have 15, 14, 13, or 12 chefs, they can't get to everyone. Like, we haven't seen a lot of attention on Lisa's cooking either, right? She has not done poorly. She has done.
Lisa and Jen, both middle survivors for all three episodes.
And maybe that's just
the bottom or top three. Yeah.
Right. They point out the real clunkers. They point out the really inspirational stuff. And they don't have time, to the extent that they can't get to everyone or have an extensive conversation about everyone's food. If you finish middle of the pack, you know, you're sort of forgettable in that sense. You make neither a positive nor a negative impression. And then finally we have Kevin, who had immunity. What was interesting is he bombed his dish, right? It was a lamb loin, glazed carrots, and a feta carrot top, which actually I liked on the plate. It kind of reminded me, like, oh, this is Kevin's rendition of a steakhouse cream spinach. You know, cutting up the carrot tops and with feta, it looked like that. And I wasn't expecting it to be bad. There was an olive sauce, apparently. What was interesting is when he got back there after getting dinged in front of the judges, he said, oh, this was about, you know, taking a big swing, or I forget how he said it, you know, throwing shit against the wall. But did it look that risky? It wasn't like,
no.
Oh, he tried something crazy. He just, I don't know, maybe he just phoned it in, as you said.
Yeah, I think he phoned it in, mailed it in, and you know, I think aesthetically and from an inspirational dish, I just don't think it was. I think he mailed it in, and I think when you're Kevin at this point, that's okay. And their strategy here is mail it in, get your DNP rest. Make sure that, you know, you're not out of shape going into the next game. You don't want to lose your conditioning going into the next game. But hey, you know what? Getting a load management day during an elimination challenge this early in the game, it might serve you well later. So kudos to Kevin. I like the strategy here is that you don't want to burn on both ends here. So he didn't have a really great dish here, and that's okay. That's why you have immunity. And by the way, Jamie, props to you for owning it earlier in this episode, saying if I get immunity, I'm not giving it up. Because Kevin, if he gave up his immunity in this episode and produced that dish, he might have been going home.
Yeah, so I somewhat agree with you. I just don't think that, you know, cooking for 4 hours poorly is any much less taxing on one's body or load than cooking well. I'd like to see my top draft pick kind of nail it, or at least kind of get in the middle. Again, I'd feel better if he did something truly crazy. Like, I'm just going to look, I can cook whatever I want here. It was a lamb loin with some glazed carrots. I mean, shit, Tom, I could do glazed carrots. I mean, anybody
can. I was going to say, I feel like I could have done that dish, and obviously I can't. But yeah, that was a dish that I didn't feel like was something I'm going to go super inventive here.
Also, I do believe in momentum, and here's a guy who's coming off of a brilliant win last week, just killed the quickfire challenge earlier in the episode, and just wanted to see him sustain it, because I do think these things in this particular show can be self-fulfilling. I don't think there's such a thing as a regression to the mean. I think competence in the kitchen compounds itself over time, and so I was just a little bummed. Just thought, hey, and also, again, I'm not bummed that he laid an egg. I'm bummed that he didn't lay a more creative egg.
Yeah. No, I hear what you're saying. But you know what? He got the immunity, and there were four at the bottom this episode, which, you know what? In weeks past, we talk about whether we like the whole team aspect here. I didn't quite feel – maybe Stephanie. Like, who in the bottom four? We had Karen, Leanne, Stephanie, and Jamie in the bottom four. Were any of those dishes, do you think, that were unqualified for being in the bottom four? Or do you think that was a fair bottom four?
No, unless you believe that Jen Carroll, Gregory, Lisa, or Nini had a worse dish than Stephanie. I didn't see – because those were the middle winners or the middle winners. Those were the middlers in age category. My sense was, you know, Nini's wasn't the most beautiful to look at, so she got a middle. Lisa just had a nice dish, but it wasn't as good as Voltaggio's. Gregory might, as we've talked about, have the second best dish, so he certainly wasn't going. And then, you know, by definition, Jen was ahead of Karen. Had Karen's dish been better than Jen, she wouldn't have been on the bottom by definition.
Right.
So the truth is I think we got the four – least refined, or not refined, just the least good dishes. So I don't think there was anybody who got, unlike Gregory, who I think probably got robbed from a judge's winners lineup because he happened to be in a group with the best dish in the day.
So the question is, if Kevin didn't have immunity, would he have been in the bottom four? Karen said, if I go home because Kevin has immunity, I'm going to be pissed. So do you think she had a bone to pick there?
Well, in this sense, I think Padma pretty much said that Karen wouldn't be standing there. But look, I think don't be pissed. You know, in other words, you have to beat two other chefs. It just so happened that you had the fourth chef. But truthfully, you would have been there anyway had Kevin chosen some other team.
Control what you can control. And she did not do that.
Right. Like, and look, Karen's my chef, and I love what she's doing this season. But at the end of the day, you know, you don't want to be on the block. Beat two other chefs. Just beat two other chefs. That's all you have to do to not be on the bottom. But as it was, she wasn't even considered. I think there was an understanding that Jamie and Leanne were the true contenders for elimination here. Right? Like Stephanie, one error. They liked a lot about her dish. She just undercooked the pasta. You know, Karen's was boring, but it wasn't like she just absolutely it lacked a little flavor. But it wasn't it certainly didn't violate. It just didn't conform to
monochromatic. It was not. Right. I think you're right.
It was no way Jamie and Leanne. Right. To neoclassical. So it was those two. And then, you know, though Leanne did get the Kintsugi Award for culinary chaos, it wasn't chaotic enough to lose to a dried clunk of a chunk of chicken without any sauce. And that went.
After being in the top for the first episode with Stephanie and with Gregory at the beach. Jamie has an exit here for not having a jus and also having an overcooked chicken. He goes home. The Charlotte's own Jamie Lynch. I am sorry to see him go on this competition. You know, he was my last pick on my team. So I'm not crying too much that I lose Jamie on my team, but man, it didn't feel like he deserved to stay on after that dish. I think it was a well-deserved elimination compared to the rest of the dishes. I'm sorry to see him go after such a strong start out of the gate. And Leon lives to see another day in the competition.
Yeah, a little concerned about Stephanie. I thought she had a really strong week one. Last week was sort of a crisis of confidence. This week, fortunately, it was just a crisis of execution. I don't think she had a good idea. Most of it was well executed. The pasta was undercooked, obviously a killer, but
hoping to get a bounce back from Stephanie. Hoping after last week serving up the Indian dish to Padma that she would have a big bounce back. And you know, the tortellini dish, it was a mid dish. It was something that I think in normal episodes she would have been in the middle of the pack. But still, like you said, didn't bounce back in a very promising way for Stephanie. The last two episodes, she's been in the bottom. The only contestant so far that has been in the bottom for two straight weeks. So after being in the high, the top three, she is now in the bottom three for the last two episodes. So she's got to really turn things around for you, Kev.
Yeah, she is. One other comment about the show itself. Recording in Los Angeles in the early and mid-fall is, I think it's a little unfortunate because one of the things I'm noticing is a lot of root vegetables, some sweet potato. I think we are unfortunately missing out on some of the great summery produce that you get in Los Angeles. And I'm already noting, I don't need this. Root vegetables are just this unfortunate thing we have to deal with until we get to spring and summer.
So what's an ingredient in L.A., summer L.A., that you're missing right now in this competition?
Asparagus and okra and just sort of like fresher greens and just bright or stone fruit. Mm-hmm. Although we did see some peaches in week one, so I shouldn't say maybe it was late early enough that they still got some of that. It's just – there's just more vibrant English peas. Though we did see a few of those. I think we saw some snap peas that were used in that. But I don't know. It's just I'm seeing a lot of root vegetables. And I love beets as much as the next guy. And I've enjoyed cooking beets here, and I do it a lot. But, you know, it's root vegetables. It's a slightly less interesting kind of cupboard or produce drawer than you would want. And it's not a complaint. I'm noticing it, and it's like, oh, yeah, this is cooking in Los Angeles when you get to fall, or anywhere for that matter. There's a little less to choose from. But and then you're not early. You're too early for citrus, though. So it's just kind of a weird period. Tom, let's talk about Last Chance Kitchen, speaking of Jamie and chicken, and Joe Sasto's waiting for him there.
I love this Last Chance Kitchen, Kevin. I love the gamesmanship of – let's play a little game of chicken. And man, Tom Colicchio was just needling Jamie every opportunity that he had.
You think he was having a good time?
Oh, he was having the best time. I mean, when you were looking at Tom just saying, all right, let's play a game of chicken here. How many minutes do you think you would need to produce a winning chicken dish? And it became this little auction back and forth. Do I hear 25? Do I hear 25? 25. There is a 24. Do I hear 24? And I'm sitting here just cringing every time because you had these two bros who were like out trying to out masculine each other a little bit here, being like, I could fucking do 22 minutes on a chicken dish. Watch me. I'll go 20. And he was just playing them. And I felt like Tom was just playing them like a violin. Because you could sense a little bit of machismo in there being like, yeah, I could do a 10-minute chicken dish. Watch me. And then once it got to 20 minutes, so the conceit of the Last Chance Kitchen was, let's do chicken, a whole chicken. You can do whatever you want, but you do an auction going down the number of minutes you want to complete the dish. And so they auctioned it off, and it went down, down, down until – 20 minutes. And Kevin, that's not a lot of time for a chicken dish.
This is my own theory about why Jamie lost to Joe, but I think at the end of the day, it's thighs versus skinless, boneless breast. I don't.
What are you doing?
And look, Jamie's a professional. I am not. I've never seen a situation where skinless, boneless breast is something that you give fussy eaters who like the fact that like, somebody who doesn't like chicken skin, I mean, which to me is an alien. I mean, who doesn't like chicken skin? Like my Jewish mother and her friends don't like chicken skin. Like everybody else in the world likes chicken skin. And, you know, dark meat versus white meat. If I'm going to do white meat, I have to brine it. And this is kind of what I do. I do this chicken breast where I brine overnight and then I kind of sear the skin side and then put it in take that pan and put it in the oven for 10 minutes. But like, who likes skinless, boneless breast? Oh my God. Nobody likes that. Nobody likes that.
Olympian, maybe? Some sort of
right,
Olympian?
Exactly. Like somebody who's again, my mother and her friends who need the sauce on the side and, you know, nothing fried. And I mean, it's just a very specific brand of eater who's extremely health conscious, as am I. I mean, I get it, but it's just if you're in a cooking competition show, I don't see any scenario by which, you know what I want from that chicken? The skinless, boneless breast. It just doesn't create enough fat to really get what you want accomplished. And so I think that was sort of my theory is when the minute I saw that, I'm like, oh, this is over.
Yeah. Last night I had some fried chicken from my favorite restaurant in town, the Stanley, here in Charlotte. They did a takeout, fried chicken. And when you get that like bit of fried chicken where you're not sure if it's bone or if it's just a really crispy corner of the fried chicken and you just munch on it waiting for the bone, but it's no bone in there. It's just straight chicken skin and it is fried. It is delicious. Shouts to Paul Verica, who's the James Beard Award nominee chef from the Stanley. It was a delicious dish and it reminded me, Jamie Lynch here in Charlotte, I'm curious to see if at Five Church in Charlotte, he's going to have a chicken dish on his menu. Because man, I bet if I'm Jamie Lynch, I am sick of chicken.
I'm getting a little sick of chicken too, because it's my primary protein here during the lockdown in Los Angeles. Tom, we have some business to take care of. And do you want to, for our listeners who might just be kind of coming in mid-season, would you like to explain the Lisa situation?
So Lisa was the 15th chef testant in our 14-player chef testant draft. And the way it worked, the way we agreed on it, and I'm glad we did it after three episodes, but she was going to be on the waiver wire, is that the 15th chef who was not selected in our 14-chef draft was going to be on waivers for a few weeks. The waiver wire period would end after 3 weeks. After the third episode, we would then bid on our points. We have, just for people who are listening at home, I have 60 points. You have 36, and I believe we are doing a cost auction where we are bidding for the rights to Lisa to be added to your team off the waiver wire based on who has the highest bid on her services.
Right. So I'm going to get my text out. We text each other, right? So I'm going to propose that.
Wait. No, here's what I think we should do.
All right. Kevin. You're a better systems guy here. Yeah.
Here's what I think we should do. I'm going to say 3, 2, 1, go. But instead of saying go, I'm going to say 3, 2, 1. And then in place of go, both of us are going to say the number of our bid. And that way the listeners at home can participate here. So I'm going to say 3, 2, 1, go. But instead of saying go, we're both going to shout out our bid. So again, whoever has the highest number gets to add Lisa to the team. Now, I'm sacrificing those points, right, Kevin? Theoretically, I'm sacrificing those points from my total. It's not just a number. This is actually going to cost me that many points, correct?
Right. It'll come out. Right now, the score for those keeping score at home is Tom has 60 points. I have 36. I mean, you have controlled the first 3 weeks of this contest.
Okay. So, all right. So you have your number in mind, Kevin?
I do.
Okay. All right. I am going to count down 3, 2. I'm going to count down. And instead of saying go, we are both going to say our number. Ready?
Yes.
3, 2, one, five. Six. Oh, I get Lisa.
Okay. You and I were, I mean, the fact that it was only one apart, I think, says a lot.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I was thinking about five. I went with six. I thought you might go with like eight. And so I was thinking if I could get away with six. So six points off my total means I've got 54. Okay. And well, how about this? I'll just put,
you should 60. Create a new line. You should create a new line.
Yeah. And she would be minus six in here.
Right. Or just with a different color coding just to demonstrate that,
yes,
like a blue or something, and then a little asterisk or, and you know, something like that. For those, no one can see exactly what's going on in our Google Doc right now. This is ridiculously bad podcasting that we're trying to just come up with a system. I love working with Tom Haberstroh. That's all I can say. There's no other psychopath in the world other than me who would understand like the decision making here. So this was my theory. So what we're basically saying is you think she's going to have a, so if we assume that she's going to get eliminated at some point, that's negative five. So what you're basically saying is you think Lisa is going to have 11 points or more before she is gone from Last Chance Kitchen.
She's laying in the weeds right now. She's laying in the weeds. She's in the middle for three episodes. In our point system, Kevin, interestingly enough, she has 6 points. Like, where she doesn't count for 6 points on my team yet because she hasn't done anything for my team. But she and Jen Carroll have 6 points so far in this competition, because you get 2 points for every episode that you were not in the top or bottom three. You're just finishing in the middle. So in my head, I don't know whether the six was sticky in my head, but I kind of feel like in order for her to win out, I think she has the opportunity to win an episode. She doesn't have much of a storyline so far in this show. I kind of feel like she's probably got the least amount of camera time. Like if we did a 538 analysis or Wall Street Journal analysis.
Like they do for the Democratic debates and stuff?
Yeah.
Who gets the most talking time?
Who gets the most talking time? I'd imagine that Lisa might have the lowest right there with Jen. And ironically, maybe not ironically, maybe that is the point, is that they're in the middle of the pack, so they're the least interesting in terms of the extremes. And so I get Lisa on my team. And so she's cost me 6 points. So it's going to knock my total score from 60 to 54. Kevin, you're at 36. You do not lose 5 points, correct?
That's correct.
That's correct. You do not lose 5 points for your bid, that failed bid. So you get to maintain your 36. You do not have Lisa on your team. So I have Gregory, Eric, Brian Voltaggio, Melissa, Jen, Leanne Wong, and replacing Jamie Lynch on my team after his loss in Last Chance Kitchen. Welcome to the team, Lisa.
Yeah, I think she's cooking really well. And I don't want my five to be a – I mean, again, I think I'm somebody who believed that she'll have another 10 points before she's gone, which, by the way, 10 is a lot. I mean, 10 is if you don't win, it's – you know, like, for instance, Eric only has 8 points through 3 weeks, right? You know, it's cooked very well. Nene only has 9 points through 3 weeks. I mean, 10 points is a lot, and I'm essentially saying that's how many she's going to get before elimination, not including Last Chance. So,
well, you know what also that incorporated in my bidding process here? I think it matters. I think I paid a little bit of a premium to not give you another opportunity here because you're knocked down a few chefs. So I have a little bit more money to play with here. And, you know, in the Sam Hinkie style of managing your roster, you're getting more at bats with Lisa. If you were to get Lisa, you get more opportunities, more swings, more bites out of the apple for winning this Top Chef fantasy team. So I think I maybe have added a couple more dollars because if I had 60 points or if I had 16 points, maybe I'm not doing six, but I kind of feel like I'm playing a little bit of keep away against you.
Right. And I get that. I get that. So this will be looking forward to next week. Tom, we are down to how many chefs now? We have – the show now has 12, correct?
12 chefs. I have 7 alive, and you have 5. You have Kevin, who's just been cooking his tail off. He just won a quick fire just by, you know, waltzing into that and just saying, I don't know how to do this, but I'm going to win a quick fire anyway. Kevin – is, I think, as strong as anyone in this competition, maybe the strongest. But Brian Voltaggio, even though he has no wins, he's been in the top three for 2 weeks in a row. The only chef in this competition, Kevin, that has been in the top three or winning in consecutive weeks. So Brian's a little bit of a hot streak right now. Even though he hasn't won, he's been in the top three. So I'm feeling pretty good about my squad right now with the addition of Lisa Fernandez.
But right now, I'll tell you, Tom, I think the story of the season, and I don't, this is not recency bias, is Melissa King. And one of the interesting things I wanted to see coming into the season was we've all seen these chefs cook. And it is just logical that any craftsman, whether it's been 2 years since they've been on the show or 5 or 10 in some cases, people get better at their trade. They just do. You become a better chef over time. I suspect there's a prime, and it'd be really interesting to ask the chefs when they start coming on as guests, hey, when does a chef, is it in their 50s? Is it in their early 60s? Is it like late 40s? Is it just one of those skills that, you know, the sheer hunger drives you to your greatest heights? But what's been fun about Melissa is of all of these chefs, she is the one that I'm like, oh, she's a different chef than she was 2 or 3 years ago when she was on the show. I mean, that is, to me, kind of, that is her defining quality. Is I think Karen's cooking better than she did, but of all of the chefs, Melissa has shown the most growth through 3 weeks versus her last. She's just clearly has made, I mean, she's in a different stratosphere than she was. When she was on this, she was very good. She finished fifth, but now she's cooking with incredible confidence.
Yeah, I'm feeling pretty good about you not taking that deal earlier in the season. Was it, and Angelo for Melissa? So that deal, yeah. By the way, Kevin, not on the table anymore.
Yeah, I imagine. I'm feeling that was, yeah. You know what? It also gets me thinking. Maybe the 2-for-1 deal isn't as unfavorable as I thought.
If you want the best player in the deal, you might have to do a 2-for-1. You know what? That's, you know, some people believe in that theory, is always just get the best player in the deal. And Melissa was the best player in that deal. Are there any trade anyone on my team that you're willing to talk shop, or do you want to save it for another episode?
I mean, I'm kind of the belief that anybody I'd want, you won't trade, and anybody you trade, I wouldn't want. I mean, that's kind of how I feel about it right now. So
yeah. No, any offers for Jen? Jen has been in the middle for 3 weeks. Are you comfortable not having her on your team?
I'm comfortable. I mean, I'm even wondering, would I trade Stephanie for Jen? I feel like there'll be a regression to the mean there. Maybe Stephanie's just not that good a cook. I don't know, for this show. I'm not as good a competitor, but I still have confidence. There's something there I still like. The nacho, Indian nachos, gives me a little pause again. And it's not even the Padma thing. It is, come on. This is Top Chef All Stars. What do you
think? Malarkey for Jen?
I don't know, Tom. I think Malarkey, when he doesn't talk himself into stupidity, is a good chef. Not a great chef, but I think he's a guy who can get some top three finishes. I think he's a guy with enough technical skill to avert disaster. You know, I mean, his disasters or his weak moments tend to be more conceptual than execution. And so I just kind of think he might be nerding around for a while. I thought he'd be out of the competition, but now I kind of feel like he's got enough to get in.
A little recency bias, a little bit. I'm just trying to see. I put that on the table. The proposal has been submitted to Team Kevin's.
Wait, Carol for Malarkey?
Yes.
Carol for Malarkey. I'll think about it. We might have some midweek
transactions. Yeah. Okay.
For other consideration. Right. Yeah, we'll think about this. Right. We will think about this.
We have some time on our hands, Kevin. So yeah. Let's that proposal has been submitted to the HQ via. I didn't even go to an assistant GM for this proposal, and it goes up the chain. I'm going straight to the GM here and saying Jen Carroll for Brian Malarkey, straight up. Team Tom, Team Kevin, no bells and whistles. Maybe we can talk some draft picks going forward. Just any sweeteners to add into the deal. But that is the proposal.
And I will have an answer for you before next week. I will have an answer for you.
Okay. Kelly Clarkson is on the next episode. So I'm going to get up my, my pipes here, my vocal cords, and get ready for Kelly Clarkson.
Eric Schwartzel is very excited about this.
Oh, I did not know that Eric is a big Kelly fan.
Eric took his mom when she came out from Western Pennsylvania, and they went to the Kelly Clarkson show.
Is he an American Idol super fan, or is it just post-American Idol that he fell in love with Kelly?
I know nothing about the musical reality shows. All I know is every time I open my DVR now, there's another goddamn episode of The Voice recorded on the top. Like that's so I think the answer is yes. I now like the thing about musical reality shows is I now know what non-sports fans feel when like the game is on or when people are talking about basketball and they're not basketball people. It's like Eric had his book club friend over a couple of weeks ago, and they just talked for 10, 15 minutes about I think it might have been The Voice. It might have been American. I don't even know what it was. But it was like, oh, this is what non-sports fans feel when there are a bunch of sports fans at the table. So I think it's musical reality shows or sports for non-sports fans. This is my theory.
Kelly Clarkson participated.
I didn't really know who that was. I didn't know who that was.
You didn't know who Kelly Clarkson was?
I did not.
Oh, my goodness.
I honestly didn't. I couldn't have picked her out of a lineup.
Wow, Kelly Clarkson. She participated in the ALS Pepper Challenge, Kevin. She did a video and was like – like People Magazine picked it up because she ate a habanero and just kind of was like, I feel like I can do this. And it was an amazing video. I should post that when the episode runs. It's a great video to watch. She really suffered for habanero. So thank you, Kelly Clarkson, for doing that. Can't wait to watch next week's episode. And since you've been gone, you don't know that song? I can't breathe for the first time.
All of this is lost on me. I live in a treehouse by myself.
So many lies. Yeah, yeah. All right. Well, on that note,
is something to look forward to. Yes. For Tom Haverstraw, this is Kevin Ornovitz, and this is Pack Your Knives.
See you, big guy.